Hello and welcome to The Vinyl Exam, the podcast about vinyl records and the people who collect them. My name is Sama.
And my name is Keith. And for those of you that are adept at this thing called words and what they mean, you will know that this is part one of our two-part finale for The Vinyl Exam.
Vinyl Exam is coming to a close in a way.
In a way. We'll get to that in due time. But I suppose it's only fair to start with, I don't know, man. I mean, I think let's start with the fact that, you know, we've done this podcast for a long time. And mm-hmm. Sama, I know you can go into details when you want here. And we've talked about a lot of things. And I think maybe for with some details to come, I think both of us really feel like we've said all there is to say, or at least we've said all we've set out to say, and much more. And so I know Sama on the way driving home just now, because we're recording this on a weeknight evening, I listened to our first episode. I just wanted to go back and see what we thought on episode zero, right? And, you know, in that grand old time of July 2014, when the world was so different. That's right. So, like, we set out to do this stuff. There was part of me when I was listening, as I was thinking about it, I'm like, is it right? Are we right to end this? I did think about that for a lot of the drive home, but I think the answer is yes. I think I've always been a proponent. I'd rather leave the party 5 minutes too early than 5 minutes too late. Exactly. I'd rather kind of go out on a high note like Jordan the first time instead of Jordan the second time. So let's do that. Let's hold our shot and walk off with the win here at the end of game six.
That's right. Yeah. And I see it as a transition because, you know, I don't feel like, like for me, the Vinyl Exam has always been a chapter in my journey through music. You know, like when my intro to music was, I would say really hardcore was in college when I got into b-boying and then into record collecting. And then I was keeping a blog about 45s for a while. And the Vinyl Exam just became like the next chapter in an exploration. Like, how do you interact with music and particularly with records? And I think for me now, it's not so much like we're ending the Vinyl Exam, it's that we're ending this particular format, which is the podcast. Yes. And we're transitioning into another exploration, which I'm really excited about. So we'll get into that in a little bit. So I just want to just put that out there in terms of like, yeah, this feels totally natural to me that we did 175 episodes and this is the time that we are now transitioning or pivoting, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Again, you know, I'm sure there's part of it where 200 would have been a more round number, but numbers are just numbers, you know, and
numbers is numbers, man. You have that, you know, the statistics aspect of it, and you know better than me, right? Numbers are just numbers.
Exactly. There could be an alternate version of this reality where everything is the same, except that we all view like the 75s as the monumental things instead of the centuries. Right. Like, oh, my that's God, right, you lived right. to 75. Yeah. That's amazing. That's, you know. Yeah. But so, I mean, I think to start things off, I think we want to talk about, I don't know. I mean, maybe our favorite things. I don't know. Why don't you go first? Just talk about whatever you want to talk about. We'll go from there.
For those who don't know, I left San Francisco about a year and a few months ago. And my interaction with the music scene has changed dramatically after leaving San Francisco, which is like a musical hub. You know, I would go Absolutely. From, you know what I mean? Like there were just so many record shops up and down Haight Street alone. And we've talked about that a lot on the show. And I would spend time at the record shop almost, you know, at least you know, once or twice a week, I would go to the record shop and just hang out, not even buy records, just spend time there. And when I got to New Jersey, to Princeton, which is, you know, much smaller town, things
and suburban.
Oh yeah, that's right. Absolutely suburban, right? Like there's.
I mean,
Princeton is small, you know.
And it's also there's, like the geographic. When I tell people here about what New Jersey is like, I basically say, and you know, this will probably offend some people in Jersey, but I lived there for a while, so whatever. New Jersey is basically like kind of three things. It's a big Philadelphia suburb. It's a big in the south. It's a big New York suburb in the north, and it's also a wonderful beach area. And
yeah, yeah,
those are kind of like the three. And then there's also a big area where nobody lives, the Pine Barrens. And Princeton has this strange thing of being the, you know, if it's not the geographic midpoint, it's the observed midpoint between New York and Philadelphia, right? It's the place where New Jersey has a lot of its strongest identity, perhaps even New Brunswick, where it feels the most like New Jersey, or at least where New Jersey feels like its most unique individual thing.
That's right.
As opposed to a version, an iteration of the large cities that it is absolutely part of, that only a river and a state boundary really make you make it feel like it's not part of those areas, right?
That's right.
So
that's right.
Yeah,
that's
I mean, right. In Princeton, I can't remember if they black out Philadelphia football games or New York football games. They might black out neither. Where if you drive 10 right, miles north, right. They black out New York football games. If you drive 10 miles south, they black out Philadelphia football games.
It's exactly right. Like you have to actually travel to get to where you want to get to, you know. And so what ended up happening is like my entire musical world has changed, you know. Like I've already moved twice. I'm now just settling into my second home. I got a dog, which has been a new thing for me too. And I've been playing a lot more guitar. So my interaction with music has shifted from spending time at the record shop to kind of more of a solo exploration of music, which is just like on my own, me and my dog at home playing guitar mostly. I think that's been something that's definitely shifted how I view or perceive or interact with my records, and also my you know, the nostalgic feelings I have about San Francisco, which are very conflicted. You know, like I have some very positive and also some very negative feelings about San Francisco. And I think when I look at my records, that kind of gets carried with it. So there's been the moments where I'm like, oh, I want to play this record, but then it's been just like, ah, oh, this will bring up so many negative memories. Let me just go play guitar. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You could make the argument that, and maybe this is the type of feelings you're talking about, but as an impartial observer, I feel like you were probably there for what I view as the last great era of San Francisco before it's kind of turned into this overblown tech center that's just spiraling out of control and doesn't know what to do with itself.
That's right. Yeah. It's just like, you know, there's some bittersweetness there. So, I mean, that's, you know, Princeton has a, you know, funny enough, there's a bunch of people here who are record collectors. But just that the way that they collect records is so different than the way San Franciscans, I think, or at least how I perceive them to collect records and interact with records. So people here, you know, there are not many DJ gigs that you can go to on a nightly, you know, weekly basis. Like in San Francisco, there'd be multiple parties on a Tuesday that you have your pick from, with like, you know, different DJs and collectives of DJs playing. And here, there's record collectors, but everyone's kind of siloed. You know, so you spend a lot of time at your friend's house listening to records. You know, actually, my friend Jamal and my friend Corey were talking about starting a record exchange between us. You know, like we just like swap records for a week. You know, so the people are here, but just that the way we interact with the music is just completely different than what I'm used to in living in a big city my entire life. You know.
Yeah, it makes sense. In San Francisco, you sit in Rookies, and everything comes to you. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Record collectors, records, musicians, people throwing parties, everything makes its way to you. And all you have to do is sit there. Right.
Just chill.
In Princeton, it's a bit different.
You got to work a lot more. Yeah. And also, yeah, I've played out only once in the last year. And you know, as opposed to like at least once a month, I would play a gig. And it was like a warehouse party that Jamal organized. And it was a lot of fun, man. It like brought me back to like all the good times I had just like, you know, making people dance with music that I like, you know. And it just kind of like brought all that back to the forefront, you know. So these are things that like, you know, that have shifted for me, and I wish I had been more diligent about capturing that for the show. But I think it's also kind of part of this idea of me transitioning into, you know, exploring records differently, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, it's fair to say that while you've had more visible life changes from the curb than I have, right? I mean, you've obviously moved across country. You have a different life. You're not a PhD student anymore, right? You're a postgrad worker. You've moved from a big city to a rural setting. You know, the visible aspects of that change are obvious. In my case, I've undergone a lot of change as well, but it's not as obvious, right? On one hand, my live-in girlfriend is now my wife, right?
That's right.
That's not different. I moved a mile to a new house that I'm renting, so that's not really different. The kids are still the kids. That's not different. I still love music. That's not different. But a lot of the other stuff is different. When I listen back to a lot of the earlier vinyl exams, Big Pimp Jones was a thing. And right. And when we first started Vinyl Exam, Big Pimp Jones had released an album as recently as 2011. And I think even by the time we recorded our first episode, I don't think our record on Funk Night had even come out yet. And a few records on Record Breakin' haven't come out yet. So,
right.
You know, that's that, you know, I was kind of square in the middle, and then we ended up kind of releasing our own 45s and doing things like that. But the comic book stuff was just starting to happen. You know, everybody's had a life change, right? Like the three members of Big Pimp Jones, including me, have all had, you know, changes in a lot of ways, right? Like Ruckus, Ruckus is, his kids have grown up and are at college, he's definitely going out there and doing some mini tours. He's not only a funk bassist, but he's an extreme metal bassist. So his metal band Dark Waters End is having some success, which is awesome. Frank actually has a newborn and I believe a new wife since 2014, right? I mean, he had been single for a while, but he's married again and has a young kid. So that obviously changes a whole lot too. You know, in my case, you know, Big Pimp Jones is kind of we're always a text message away from wanting to record some new music, but you know, my music tastes have changed a little bit too, at least in what I'm trying to make, and I can talk about that a little bit later too.
Another
big dramatic change, I've written the first draft of a novel, and that's something that I've really fully committed to over the past year. I'm very quiet about it. I don't make a big deal about it, but it's been a lot of work. It's been a lot of wonderful work. It's been fun. I've been taking a ton of classes at UCLA to do it. So this isn't just, you know, me doing it without some expert guidance, I suppose. I have mentors, I have friends, I have fellow writers that are helping me through this process. And as of a week ago, I finished the first draft of a, you know, 400-page novel where I actually probably wrote about 600. I probably threw out about a total of 200 pages. And
that's incredible.
It's nowhere near being done. But it's worth celebrating that I do have a completed first draft of a novel. So as I've been instructed, that novel is sitting in a drawer for me not to look at for a while. And, you know, maybe end of first quarter 2019, I'll take a look again. But I'm doing my best to kind of catch up on some things that I have kicked to the side as that's happened and maybe not looked at as much. And a lot of that is just personal stuff. But so that's it too. And as I've done that, you know, I've really enjoyed the journey. I've never really read novels for pleasure, and I do that now. And I just continue to dive more and more into the literary world and enjoy it and try to analyze it. You know, it's one thing to read a book. It's another to try to analyze it like someone who's writing a book. And that's right.
Yeah.
That's what I'm being told, right? That's what I'm being taught. And it's really enjoyable. And I think when you add all those things up, combined with the fact that musically I'm just in a different place, and anybody who listens to The Vinyl Exam can know the place I'm in right now, because I've been hinting it. It's 90% of the music I listen to is extreme metal now. And it's not that I don't love funk. It's not that, you know, I wouldn't make some more funk. It's just, it's what interests me. You know, eight of the other 10% is blues, you know, and I don't know. I'm starting to feel a lot of hip hop again, which is fun. It's fun to kind of rediscover a lot of that. But funk is like just it's sitting here in my collection to my right. But I haven't taken out a funk record to listen to in like 3 years, you know.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's funny how that happens. You know, there's like these kind of ebbs and like it's like the tide going in and out, you know. It's like
totally.
this genre you just absolutely love and adore, and then all of a sudden it becomes like too loud or too tinny or too predictable or something, right? And then you forget about it for a second, and something else new pops in, you know?
Yes. I'd like to stay right there real quick, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Predictable is a very close word to what I feel about funk right now. And I was telling somebody else about this, that there's something about the genre of funk that's bothering me, right? And and it's that it feels so limiting. It just feels like if, you know, like the best way I can put it is, I'll put it kind of in a reverse way, which is the reason why metal and hip-hop have always been two of my favorite genres and probably will continue to be two of my favorite genres is that they are very inclusive genres of style, right? Sure. That hip hop, you know, somebody said this in a, I think somebody was talking about Method Man one time and referenced that Method Man could rhyme over country and it would still be meth, right? Mm-hmm, and right. I love that quote for a lot of reasons. And one of the reasons I love the quote is because I think it speaks to hip hop too, in that hip hop could sample country and be hip hop. And that's what makes it so cool. You know, hip hop can bring in any other element of music and make it hip hop. And it's inclusive and it's always moving and breathing and living. And maybe we don't like the directions it takes sometimes, but at least it's always grabbing more real estate, right?
That's right.
And I think metal in a lot of ways does that too. Although it feels a little bit more limited, it's actually not. You know, Sama, I'd wanted to mention there's a great new band out there that I think you might actually like that's a metal band. The band is called Zeal and Ardor. And
Zeal and Ardor,
right? And and what makes them cool is that they're an experimental metal band. I think the guy's from France. One of the two guys is from France. And they started by polling people on what two like non-metal genres they'd like them to combine with metal. I hope I'm getting this story right. And you know, give me two genres and I'll make music out of it. And I believe the two genres, aside from metal, were actually, I think it was three. It was blues, extreme metal, and slave chants or slave hymns from hundreds of years ago, right?
Sure.
And it all works. Like the stuff comes together and it's amazing. And again, there's a different version of the story, but yeah, it's wonderful. What makes metal cool is that Liquid Metal, which is the Sirius XM metal station, Channel 40, plays the hell out of it. You know, like metal fans are always open to something new and something different as long as it's heavy. And I think in a lot of ways that echoes the hip hop thing, right? Hip hop is people are always willing to listen to something in hip hop as long as it's dope, right? That's it.
Right.
That's the only requirement.
Right. I come in the breath of the dead, bathing in my papa blood, bare bone and covered in red. Waiting on that evening flood, and I came on a ship on fire.
And that's why I love those two genres. And the flip side of that is exactly, it just feels like funk. It feels like the same records have been coming out for 10 years now, including mine. Not, I mean, you know, mine that are ours, Big Pimp Jones's, that are part of that genre. And I feel like the second we started to venture away into like combining funk with classical music or maybe expanding a little bit more, it just felt like we escaped the funkmosphere there, you know, and because funk was kind of a smaller bubble that seems to have a certain set of unwritten rules that make you part of the genre or not, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, I'm kind of curious. I mean, this is a really interesting topic for me because like, I remember talking to my friend Raymond about mumble rap, and he was talking about how a lot of people are like, you know, hip-hop heads with shit on mumble rap. But from his point of view, if you think about rap or hip-hop as a dynamic art form that changes over time, he said mumble rap is equivalent to like cubism, you know, in the painting world. You know what I mean? Like these guys are like the Picassos of, you know, nobody like, you know, if you think about like some of the major artists that, you know, Cezanne and Picasso and all these guys, like a lot of their stuff wasn't really appreciated until much later, right? In the moment, they're just like, people are like, what are you doing? Why are you doing it this way? Like, we take, you know, photorealistic drawings. This is what we do. Why are you like changing the shapes and colors? And they kind of got the same kind of pushback. But much later on in time, people began to appreciate that kind of transition, right? So, and I think there's something special about hip hop, just like you're saying, and maybe also, and I'm not as familiar with metal music, right? But like you're saying in like the body of the fandom and the audience, there is room for growth. Like people are much more willing to accept something different in hip hop and in metal than they are in funk music. And that's probably why there's a contribution to the stagnation that you see in funk. And I agree with you. Yeah. I think really like I haven't really heard any new funk bands that I'm like, oh, this is so different. I mean, it's not like I don't like it. Like I'm like, oh, this is really cool. It sounds like, you know, something I would listen to from like the 60s or 70s, but like I'm not going to say it's new or different, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. It reminds me of there's a great line on the, he was referring to metal bands, but he was talking about, and in his opinion at the time anyway, he was saying this about metal, that many metal bands are following the same five pre-established moves that everybody else is following, right? And that's again, I'm not doing it to like say bad things about funk. I mean, if anybody wants to hit me up with some great new music that you like, and Keith, you're wrong. Hey, man, you know how to reach me. I love new music of any sort. And maybe it's just because I've been out of funk for a while, and I'm too lazy to put a funk record on again. I don't know, right? But and it's not just funk. You know, classic rock is this way too. I personally think classic rock might die over the next 10 years because it refuses to accept new bands. And what happens when all these bands stop making music? You know, the Rolling Stones can't tour forever. But then again, maybe they can. Maybe this is like Futurama and they're just going to go around in glass heads.
In heads, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I mean, but it feels like the classic rock genre is going to come to an end and there's nobody there to pick up the torch. There's absolutely nobody. So that means the genre is going to die. Right. If you don't accept new ideas and the old ideas are going to end at some point, then the genre will go.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really interesting question, even for like a music historian to kind of pursue, is like, why is it that some art forms are much more malleable and dynamic than others? You know, why are some genres more flexible than others? You know,
for sure.
Really, really curious about that, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I just riffing. It makes me wonder if part of that is human nature too. You know, like I wonder if there's something, I mean, you're the neuroscience expert, but then again, this is more psychology, but like what is it about us as people that love to like, just categorize something as a certain thing? You know what I mean? Like, oh, punk, you know, like punk music. That's interesting. Yeah. It was around from 79 to 83. You know, well, that's a shame punk isn't around anymore. And it's like, bands are making punk now. It does kind of make me wonder, or actually to use hip hop as an example, you know, there are people who lament like the death of hip hop. There are bands out there making hip hop that sounds just like music from 1993. Oh God, Blue in Exile. And there's, I mean, if they're still even making music like Blackalicious, you know, again, there's plenty more that, you know, people far more educated than me are going to talk about. But, you know, so why do we think that, you know, is it easy for us to think that as something of the past? I don't know.
I'm just curious about that. And this idea of like categorization has been, you know, like a armchair philosophy or armchair psychology thing that I've been playing with since grad school. Like, you know, my friend was like, you have to, in order to talk about something, you first have to name it. You know, mm-hmm. a thing may not even exist until you name it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's like, there's a new, this band called Kruangbin. I think that's how you say their name. They've been making a lot of appearances lately in the last, you know, few months to a few years. That their music is like psychedelic. It's funky. The drummer is like a hip hop drummer, and I love their music. And it's hard for me to be like, oh, that's psychedelic, or that's funk, or that's hip hop, because it's like a medley of all these things. And I think for me, not being able to categorize it is part of the reason why it's so tantalizing, you know, if that makes any sense. Yeah, but maybe as soon as someone calls it something, you know, and like it names it, like, oh, this is a particular kind of music, it's called XYZ, then it may lose that flair for me. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's like, maybe for music, once you are able to name something, then it becomes kind of stagnant or too solid a thing to hold on to. Oh, but I want to come back to this this book that you secretly wrote over the last we can't just let that slide. When did you start the process?
Okay.
Like, let's go back to you. When was the idea, like, when did that start germinating? And then when did
paper? I have kind of told this to people, so I do have a version of this that I'll try to keep short that kind of shows the timeline pretty well. Right. As you know, I write a comic. I write Kadoja, and I've been working on another one called Three Protectors for a while that stopped and started. And one of the big things about comics is that I write it. I don't draw it. If I don't draw it, that means I have to pay artists to draw it. And paying people to draw it. And look, I'm happy to as long as the money permits. But, you know, being that Kadoja is going to go on a little bit more. I'm going to have to scrounge up a whole lot more money to make this happen. And as much as I love comics, I'm always kind of, you know, obsessing over maybe what the next move is. And I'd been floating the idea of trying prose for a while. I feel like I may have even said that on a podcast way back in the day, but who knows, as just a medium to explore. And when you get into the cost of it, it's obviously far cheaper. Right. It's far cheaper for me to try to draw a picture with words than it is for me to pay people to draw my pictures from words. That thing had always been in the back of my head. Right. And then if I flash forward. So that's kind of like the thing that was kicking around. If I go to San Diego Comic-Con 2017, so a little bit about 16 months ago, something like that, I was walking the floor and I came across the UCLA extension. And the UCLA Extension had a table there. And I was like, oh, UCLA Extension, you know, what classes do you have? So they have all kinds of classes. They can teach you how to write screenplays, how to read audiobooks, how to do all kinds of good artistic stuff, right? And of course, novels are one of them. And so I spun the wheel and got a free T-shirt and, you know, walked away from it and was just thinking like, hey, this might be a cool thing to do, right? It might be a cool thing to do. So keep it in the back of my head. And of course, look, over the course of the of time, Rory, who was doing the art for Kadoja, you know, like I had mm-hmm. paid him back in the day, but then we'd formed such a nice relationship that we were just working as a team. Right. So I got used to working as a team on a book and then splitting the proceeds. And then Rory goes away and now I have to pay artists again up front. Right. A lot of that was like, oh, boy, here we go again. Right. And and that again, that's fine. But anyway, so that's the stuff that's kind of forming, the stuff that's leading to World War One. But what was the assassination of Franz Ferdinand was that my mm-hmm. wife saw a psychic this mm-hmm. last New Year's Day, so almost a year ago, and the uh-huh. psychic among other things. And you know, I have mixed opinions on psychics, but I got to say that some of the things that this psychic said were so dead on, I'm kind of like, well, really? One of the things the psychic said was that while I am confident in all my walks, in many walks of life, I'm not confident creatively. And that really hits home. It hit home and it continues to hit home. You know, the what the psychic said was he should trust it and he should put his work out there, let it go, put it out there. And so my wife told me about all this. And again, we're talking about, you know, the things leading up to World War One here. And and that was the thing where I was like, yeah, okay. And so I signed up for the UCLA program the next day. I signed up for Novel One. I told this story to my dad and my dad just chalked it up as nonsense, and probably, I don't know, half the people listening to this right now are thinking that's nonsense, and the other half are like, oh, whoa, that's pretty cool.
My two cents on it, you know, unsolicited, is that whatever happened moved you to action, right?
Yes.
So that makes it as real as anything to me.
Totally. That's makes a great point.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I signed up for Novel One. And then I took Novel One, and at the time I was like, hey, wouldn't it be great if I wrote a book in, like, you know, a year? And right. Of course, went through a couple instructors, and now I'm kind of sticking to this one instructor. And of course, I kind of got my wish, but there's more, right? So I ended up writing at far more of a prolific pace than I had ever expected. Now I'm at this spot where I've written, you know, a grand total of 600 pages and thrown out 200 of them, The work's just beginning. But that's okay. You know, what I want, I know what I'm going for. And what I'm going for is something that I've never gone for before in my life, right? Which is for my creative output to be put, to go through big time gatekeepers. You know, like, my goal is not to self-publish here. I've done that twice. Right. I've self-released music for a while and it worked out fine. And I ended up releasing music with Big Pimp Jones, obviously, through record labels. And that worked out wonderfully. Right. I self-published a comic, and that now has resulted in me being part of the 215 Inc. team because, gatekeepers, I suppose. And so I'm going to do it this time. But the goal is to really go through, you know, agents and ideally have that book in as many bookstores as possible. So we will see. To paraphrase 50 Cent, I'm going to do this or die trying.
That's right. Get rich or die trying. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe not get rich, because that's not what I care about, you know, but
yeah.
Well, get published or die trying. How about that?
That's right. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. And that's amazing, man. It's amazing what the things that spark us to take action are, you know, something as small as, you know, your partner coming home and just telling you a story, right? Like,
yeah.
The next day you make this big move that sets you on this path. That puts you 600 pages in a year. It's about a year, right? Like, that's
exactly.
That's unbelievable. Can you tell us anything about the book, or are you holding that as part of the, you know, not touching it for until first quarter?
I suppose with the risk of to quote my teacher, like any good alcoholic, I need to avoid triggers. So I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk lovely. About it too much, because that'll make me think about it. But I will say that it's a horror novel. It dabbles in some historical fiction. It dabbles in some history and turns that into some fiction. And we'll see how it goes. The nice thing about this is I have a lot of experience with the novel process through the writing process.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, through the music making process is what I'm trying to say, because. You know, I got to this point with the first draft where I kept on, you know, I was tweaking this, I was tweaking that. And then you mm-hmm. finally get to the point where you actually don't want to look at it anymore. And that's sure. when I knew that, you know, once I write this one scene, the novel is going to sit on ice for a couple months. And with music, I feel like I may have said this on past podcasts, but I'll know when a song is done or when an album is done. So my process is generally when it's time for the final mixes, I'll edit a final mix. Then I'll put it on my phone. And then mm-hmm. back in the day, I would burn it to disc. Mm-hmm. But now I can just put it on my phone. And then I wake up the next day and I listen to it in the car on the way to work just to give my ears a break, right? And immediately in that listen, I know what's wrong. The bass is too high. The bass is, mm-hmm. you know, too low. Guitars sound like crap, whatever it is. So I make that note. I go home. I make that fix and I repeat that process, right? Make the quick fix. Make sure it sounds better. Put that one on my phone. Let it sit. Wake up the next mm-hmm. morning. Listen to it again. Every day you listen to it, you're like, oh, that thing sounds like crap. But one day, one of those days, I wake up, I put it mm-hmm. on in the car, and all of a sudden I'm like, yep, that's right. You know what I mean? Yeah, that's the only way I can explain it, right? I don't say it's good. I say mm-hmm. all the levels are right and I feel good about it now. It kind of all sits into place. You know, I suppose the place where all the ingredients become a dish. Thank official Vinyl Examiners Brian Siebold and Yan Wong, and executive producers Janine Cuevas, Austell Gray, and Ben Lack.